You've stopped in at the Guidepost, brought to you by the American Saltwater Guides Association. Stock up on gear, grab a coffee at the counter, and get ready to hear incredible fish stories from the best captains on the East Coast and thought-provoking conversations with stakeholders and policymakers working to protect these fisheries. This podcast is presented by Costa Sunglasses.
What is up, everyone? Welcome back to the Guidepost. Captain Cody Rubner here hosting a podcast. I think Tony is in the trenches right now working on false albacore management, and all the other great voices you've heard on these episodes are on the water or doing some form of fisheries work at this point in time. But I'm pretty excited about this episode because this is something that's just near and dear to my heart as a marine biologist. We're going to talk about something that's directly connected to our angling community, but extends out a little bit further past our community into some of the animals we see out on the water. So without spoiling it anymore, I am joined by Jessica Pate today. Jessica, how are you doing?
I'm doing great.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for joining. And we're going to jump right into it. So Jessica is the founder of the Florida Manta Project, and she also works for the Marine Megafauna Foundation. And so, Jessica, we connected, I think maybe a year or two ago over, I saw your work on manta rays, and I just personally love manta rays. I think they're awesome. Seeing them out on the water, it's always been one of those fascinating marine life that's had my attention outside of fishing. So we connected, and I think I started following you and seeing a little bit more about your research, and have helped kind of expand that guide network of, you know, people who can call and, hey, we see some mantas here. So why don't you just take a little step back and tell us a little bit about the project and maybe your background and what brought you into the project?
Yeah, well, what first got me interested in studying manta rays is I moved to Florida after my undergraduate degree in North Carolina. And so I was doing sea turtle nesting surveys here in Florida. So if anyone's been up early on the beach in Florida, you see the people riding down the beach on the ATVs. So that was me. I was out on the beach every day. And every now and then I would see a manta ray swimming by in like 3 feet of water. And I couldn't believe that we had these manta rays right in our waters. And like no one knew anything about them. There were no studies on them, nothing published. And I kind of found that amazing. So if you fast forward 7 years between me seeing my first manta, I went to grad school, worked on a sailboat, sailed around the Caribbean, and then came back to Florida and started the Florida Manta Project just to learn more about these manta rays. Like our first question was, are there even enough manta rays here to study? Because most people told me that there were not. Which I think is mostly due to the fact that divers aren't seeing them. And, you know, lots of places in the world where people see them, it's at cleaning stations or at feeding aggregations, and they see them on the reefs. But here in South Florida, divers don't really see them on the reefs. It's very rare, and they're seeing them like more inshore than what people are typically used to.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I guess one thing I could give for perspective if someone just kicked off this podcaster is newer to the Guidepost is we're talking right now. I'm out of Stuart, Florida. And so we're talking about the Treasure Coast of Florida down basically from what would you say the furthest southbound is, like West Palm or further, a little bit further past West Palm? Where do you guys stop your surveys and how far north do you guys look?
Our surveys are pretty much in Palm Beach and Martin County for our South Florida project, though we collect sightings and do aerial surveys all the way down to Broward and Miami-Dade. We get reports of mantas in the Florida Keys. But then we also have a project in Central Florida off Canaveral and Ponce Inlet that we do every spring with the migration of mantas that comes through. So we kind of have two different projects in two areas of the state.
Awesome. Well, yeah, I was actually just 10 or 15 minutes ago, I was on the phone with Captain Tommy Derringer, who's based out of St. Augustine, and he runs a skiff inshore for redfish and then also runs a Pathfinder bay boat when he fishes the ocean and kind of inshore too. But it was interesting. I've known Tommy for a handful of years, and we were talking about how that fishery has changed. And we'll get into the video that you guys made here recently, because that's one of the takeaways I'd love for people to take away from this podcast, but Tommy was talking about how that migration has changed a lot. And that used to be more of a thing, something he planned for. He would book a trip. Hey, you're going to come through in March. Okay, this day, you know, as long as weather permits for us to get out front, that's going to be a cobia trip. And it was because they were used to roughly this time, roughly this water temperature. The rays are moving now. They're in town. They get a call. We're going to go cobia fish. And it was very reliable. And it is interesting to hear. He said about 15 years ago from now, so roughly, you know, to call it 2010 or so, it was still a thing. And in the last 10 or so years, it's really become so unreliable. And they still see the rays. Part of that is related to the abundance of cobia in this area, which is a little bit of a, that's the fisheries discussion here. And we're going to talk a little bit more through the lens of mantas and learning more about them. But they still see the rays. Not as often. I think in the video that you guys just made that talks about angling practices around them, Blair Wiggins brought up that a lot of the rays are probably down more or more apt to go down. And so the fishery has changed. And I talked to Mike Holiday, who's local in Stewart, and he said about 15 years ago as well, was there was more of an abundance of cobia, which made interacting with the ray more of an occurrence or more of a planned occurrence. And it's become a lot more happenstance now. You run into it, you participate in it. And so the symbiotic relationship that we're talking about is cobia are very prefer to relate to structure. So see a buoy, cobia will swim around a buoy. They also love to swim with other animals, giant bull sharks, manta rays, check that box. They provide so if you've never seen a full-grown adult manta, I think some people in their head are probably thinking like the stingray touch tank if they've never been to Southeast Florida. These things are huge. I mean, what is the max wingspan that they've been documented at? It's probably 15, 16 plus feet, right? If not bigger. Higher? 25?
Yeah. So this is something I talk to fishermen about a lot, especially in South Florida, because South Florida, we have juvenile or baby manta rays. So they're always telling me, I saw this giant manta ray. It was 10 feet. I'm like, 10 feet is still a juvenile. And they're born at 6 feet across.
That's
crazy. So yeah. So we actually think this, the mantas in the Western Atlantic and Caribbean are a new species of manta. So we don't really have a good maximum size for this species, but their closest relative gets over 20 feet.
That's crazy. That's insane. I used to live in Northeast Florida. I lived there for a handful of years before moving to Southeast Florida. And I had been out on the rays in other people's boats because I had a skiff at the time. Had been out and fished it a couple times. And when you see these things breach, especially if you're close to it, it is very humbling. Very humbling how large they are. And they breach just like for a lot of our New England anglers. If you're tuna fishing and you see a humpback breach all of a sudden, it's a very similar experience where whether you're looking for them or not, when they leave the water, you kind of have your oh shit moment of like, that is a very large animal. And I am going to operate with a decent level of respect. So to start to tie it in here a little bit and get towards the project that you're working on right now, I know you're doing a bunch of research around mantas, but specifically kind of this community advocacy project working with fishermen in the angling community. What kind of prompted you guys to start this discussion about cobia angling and the overlap between the interactions with cobia and manta rays? What prompted the beginning of this work?
Yeah, really, it was talking to anglers. I didn't know that much about what was going on with mantas up in northern central Florida. There has been very little research done on it. The Georgia Aquarium did some aerial surveys where they saw lots of manta rays. But that was pretty much it. And so upon talking to a lot of anglers about like how to study this, they started telling me like just this fishery has changed in a lot of ways. And there's a lot of people out there who don't show any respect to the animals, to other anglers. And or just kind of a lot of disappointment in like how it used to be versus how it is now. And so I wanted to talk to people to see, one, like these people who've been fishing it for decades have information that no one else has. We have no baseline data on manta rays, except what we've collected now. So to learn more from them and then to learn more about how it's changed and how they think We can change it for the better.
I can unfortunately echo the sentiments of disappointed about how things used to be and how they are now. That little ethos translates across a lot of the fisheries conversations we have nowadays. But yeah, I guess to paint a picture for listeners who maybe this is new, they're not familiar with what used to happen. It would be in the spring, there would be a migration, and I'd love for you to shine. I know this is maybe some stuff that you're slowly peeling back the layers and learning about why the rays do the things they do. But there was a spring migration where sometimes you could see dozens to, I don't know what the maximum documented is, but you know, hundreds of rays, right? That are all moving up the coast. They're massive. And the in the know thing to do used to be hop out the inlet. You'd kind of see one breach, you'd work over to that area, and then you would be in a school of rays. And sometimes that would be 6 to 12, sometimes it'd be 50 to 60. And all you'd do is put your trolling motor around and just kind of bounce back and forth. And the story is, this is before my time, so I'm sharing, you know, a secondhand account here through all the guides and captains who I respect and recreational anglers who have been here a long time. Is cobia used to be very abundant across these. So you could go out and you'd kind of pick your shot. And those are some small ones. Let's just go to the next ray. Ooh, that ray has the big one. And so the fishery has changed a lot for cobia. And on top of that, the expansion of communication in the recreational angling community, there's a lot more. You guys called it out great in the video we're referencing and working towards, which is like, hey, oh my God, the rays are out there. And you do a Facebook post and all of a sudden you got 50 boats out the inlet the next day. And so being in the know and, you know, secrets best untold has had a pretty significant effect on that fishery in this neck of the woods and the abundance of cobia, but has also had an effect on rays. And I know that's where your heart lies on this, which is, as a fishing guide, not everyone is equally skilled at casting. Let's just use that blanket statement. And the unfortunate part is when you're fishing in the river for snook, if you stink at casting, you can cast, you know, hook the dock 10 times. We'll pull up, we'll pull the hook out of the dock. No harm, no foul. Maybe you're wrapped around a rope, whatever that might be. We lose a pilchard or two. But in this, the structure that you're fishing is a living animal that has done nothing wrong, then that 99.99% of anglers appreciate, respect, enjoy getting a chance to witness. And so the angling can have a negative effect on the structure, which in this specific angling case is a living megafauna. It's a large marine animal. So why don't you share a little bit more about what you guys have seen about the effects of angling on manta rays?
Yeah, so a lot of this is what we've been told, but like the fishermen we originally talked to were describing, they call them the mantas that look like Christmas trees because their pectoral fins are just full of bucktail jigs. We've seen them with missing cephalic fins. So cephalic fins are the fins that come out of the front of their face. They use these for feeding, possibly communication. When you see one of those that's been truncated, it's typically from a fishing line. And then we're just kind of like learning about the effects. One thing about the Central and North Florida, studying those mantas compared to South Florida is insanely more difficult because the vis is 5 feet. So doing stuff in water is very difficult. And they also happens during like the worst weather time of the year. So we have very few boat days where we can get work done. But one thing you'll see out there is a manta breaches, jumps out of the water, and every boat just guns for it, because it's so competitive out there. And what we've noticed out there is we've seen mating behavior out there. So like, this could be an important area where rays are mating. We also see them feeding at the surface. So I have no doubt that they get hit by boats and that these boats are causing them to probably interrupt these behaviors. The problem with this is once the mantas go a few feet below the surface, we can't see what's happening, which is frustrating sometimes.
And frustrating for anglers too. I know you guys called that out in the video as well, but as an angler, and so the video, we'll link it, we'll make a little blog as we always do. We'll share it on social so everyone can check it out. It's about a 10-ish minute video. It has a couple different anglers and guides in it, but a couple of the points that are referenced in it. One, as an angler, you want the ray to be on the surface because they're essentially the house to the fish that you're after. And so if you force the ray down, you've lost your opportunity to sight fish the cobia. And I know that's one of the most endearing parts of cobia fishing, outside of the fact that they're kind of like puppy dogs. You know, some fish, I don't know how much you fish, but some fish are like, will make you pull your hair out that you're 150 feet away from them and they kick away. Cobia, you can throw to them, hook it, they drop the jig, you can reel it in, throw it back to them, and they turn around and go like, oh, another yellow thing. You know, not always the brightest fish in this neck of the woods. So you want that ray to be up so you can interact. You guys called out a couple great things, one of which, I don't run a skiff anymore. I run a bay boat, so I run a trolling motor. And I forget which of the guests in your video called it out, but a changing of RPMs is not only affecting the ray and going to scare the ray and might affect its migration or might affect its interaction with other rays, but outside of that, you're affecting your angling opportunity. And so as you approach a ray, if you're going to approach any fishing opportunity, you should approach with tact. That's the way to do it. And so this is a great opportunity, this campaign, to educate anglers a little bit. It's not only going to help them reduce their impact on the ray, it's going to make them a little bit better angler. If you see something breach, you know, I bet our New England listeners here are immediately thinking of the guys who see an Albie blitz, they see a striper blitz, they see tuna, and the guy who goes, go, 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 and gets on the outboard and runs right into the middle of it. If you do that and you're listening, you're that guy. No one likes you. The same way with rays. Show them a little bit of respect, approach with caution, and in doing so, you're going to have better angling opportunities. So that was called out in the video. I also talked about boat positioning, and this is where some of the anglers will, you know, their antennas will turn on. About paralleling the ray and making sure that you have a good shot, and also recognizing that for a vast majority of times, you can see the cobia. The cobia will be on top of them or maybe just outside one wing. The difficult part, and I would say the symbiotic interaction that causes the most opportunity or most danger for the ray, is when the cobia is under the ray. Because when it's happening above him, depending on where the ray is, you know, you have more leeway. But sometimes cobia get right up under them, kind of ride up under their belly like they're a remora. And in doing so, that's when you start to see jigs get hooked into rays. And that's not the end goal for anyone, right? The goal, you're out there to witness, to experience, to enjoy your day, and to catch the fish you're after, not catch the ray that's housing the fish that you're after. So there were a couple other good points called out in the video that I really appreciated. And one thing that I didn't hear that I love to add is a lot of fly anglers like to target cobia because they can be, you know, very, like I said, bait happy. And so you can get their attention, get them away from the ray. And one thing that's nice is if you fish class in your leader, so essentially your tippet at the end of your fly leader, if you have a section of like 12 or 16 pound class, a lot of people, you know, class is used to kind of level the playing field when it comes to fishing and make sure that, you know, when there's record keeping, that people were using gear of the same maximum stress. But also class is a really good opportunity both for angler safety. If you ever heard about someone getting degloved, you see line get wrapped around a finger and it pulls tight on something really strong like a tarpon, or you accidentally hook that ray. Rays are really, 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 really strong. And they might move slow. I have the sin, Jess, I hope you'll forgive me. I've had one hooked on a boat that I was on once in my angling experience. And if you don't know what you're doing, that line disappears really quickly because they're going to feel the sting of the hook. And it is faster than any tarpon, or it's like probably similar to a tuna. Like you hook it and when they tick off, the drag is screaming a million miles an hour. So being able to fish class, angler safety, and also fish and ray safety, it's a lot easier to be able to just pop a spool, and no one wants to put anything in the ray. Hooking them is just unnecessary in general. But outside of that, if something was going to be hooked into them, you'd prefer it to just be the hook and not a hook and 30 to 100 feet of braid while someone's trying to figure it out. So I really appreciated all the stuff called out in the video. I guess we can chop it up on one or two more things, but I don't want to spoil it. I will link to it in all the content around this podcast. And I guess outside of people going to listen and watch the video, what are the next steps for you guys? Are you guys going to try to just continue to amplify this video and do an angler education campaign? What outside of just the angler education campaign, like what are the next steps for the Manta community around here? I'd love to hear where some of these things are going.
No, we hope that the video reaches the correct recreational anglers and that, you know, hopefully since we have like these kind of famous fishing guides in the video, that they can act as role models for people who don't really maybe know what they're doing so much. Because I understand the like the new fisherman gets out there and you see the rays and it's really exciting and you kind of like, wow, freak out. I kind of freak out when I see the rays too. I get really excited, but that it's best to just like remain calm. It's going to make everyone's experience so much better. And remember that the rays aren't, they're not going to just like go somewhere if they're breaching. They're going to stay in the same area. So it's just go over to that area slowly and just keep an eye out. And sometimes like we found when trying to do research, like the rays just don't want to stay on the surface. Like we do try to get photo ID shots of them or satellite tag them. And when they don't want to be at the surface, there's just really like, we've learned to just wait. Because we just waste a lot of time and it just doesn't work. So when they're kind of doing that behavior where they like breach and just go straight back down, we just we kind of don't do work when they're doing that behavior.
Is there any guess towards the driving factor for breaching? Is it?
There's guesses. Like one of our studies in Mozambique found that breaching occurred more during like mating seasons. So maybe it's a reproductive thing. Maybe it's a way to communicate. You know, they're feeding in these murky waters. Maybe if they breach and make a loud noise, they're very social animals. Maybe that's a way to say like, hey, there's food over here. Or maybe they're trying to get rid of those cobia and remoras that are on them. Also, it's really funny to watch the remora and cobia sail along when they breach. We have a couple of videos of it and it's hilarious.
You guys did have some great drone in the video. You guys had some great drone clips, one of which really displayed the strategy of casting, especially if the ray is associated pretty close to the center of the ray, which you don't need to throw at the ray. Cobia are, like I said, can be really playful, really easy to excite at times. So a cast outside, like bring the cobia away from the ray first. You typically can get a couple shots. You know, the fishery is changing a little bit. These fish are more pressured, so they're probably not even as open to angler interaction as they used to be. But they talked about casting away from the ray, you know, understanding where your lure is going to go once you cast. And you guys had a really great drone clip of it was casted out pretty far and you see the cobia rip off and go chase a jig or a swim bait or whatever it was. So I had to give a shout out to, I don't know.
Blair Wiggins footage. So thanks to him for letting us.
Well, Blair, great job. That's an awesome clip. And it, outside of just being fun to watch and exciting people, it also gives a little bit of education about how to be better in terms of your impact, but also in terms of angling. So, you know, it's interesting to hear there are so many questions around mantas because a lot of our listeners and the community that we roll in, there's so much data and knowledge around. Like we do a lot in striped bass management, and that's boiled all the way down to which state caught and released how many fish, you know, total discards in New York in 1982. Like there's that level of record keeping. We know all these different things that influence their spawns and each and every spawning tributary and, you know, timings of migrations and all these crazy things. So it's unique for a lot of our audience to maybe hear about something that's like, man, we don't know much crap about this thing. Is that, do you find that to be difficult in getting a grasp and learning more, or do you find it to be exciting where it's kind of like an open whiteboard and an opportunity for discovery?
I mean, it's a little bit of both, because when people ask like what I study about manta rays, I'm kind of like everything. We're trying to answer all the questions. And manta rays were listed on the Endangered Species Act in 2018. So that's when the federal government started contacting me because I was the only one here who had really any data. And they were like, what do you know? And I'm like, well, I'm just learning. I know they, at least in South Florida, we see them entangled in fishing line and hit by boats all the time. So yeah, but it would be nice. Like, we just can't say, like, is the population increasing? Is it decreasing? Because we just don't have any historical data. Like, some of the anglers I talked to suggested that, you know, maybe the migration used to start farther south, like maybe like in the Stewart area, and now it's not anymore. Like, if that's true, it could be because climate change is shifting their habitat further north. So it would be nice to have some historical data, but just because we can make better decisions with better data, but we have to kind of work with what we have. And I, you know, I'm fascinated all the time, every day.
Well, that's a good thing. And that's what drives, you know, people like us to do what we love. And, you know, ASGA's kind of ethos is better business through conservation. And we do that through science, education, advocacy. And the whole thing is trust the best available science, you know, and if we think science needs to be improved, we work within the bounds of our opportunities in the community and state and federal bodies to try to improve that science. And so science is crucial. And I really appreciate you guys, your commitment and passion for this animal and learning more about it. And I think it's going to directly lead to a brighter future for the species in general. Obviously, it's a generally a slower moving species, and a lot of its habitat and opportunities are, or its behavior creates opportunities for interaction with humans, which vast majority of the time are probably negative versus positive. And so I think it is an ignorance, and ignorance is kind of bliss deal, where it's, there's probably very, very few people. There's a couple, you know, low lifes in the world, but outside of that, it's probably very few people that actually want to negatively mess with a ray in any way. They want to see it. They want to take a photo of it. They want to FaceTime their family while, you know, they're out on the rental boat showing it, all these different things. Or, you know, someone who hits it didn't even realize they hit it. And if you told them, like, hey, you just hit that ray, you'd be, because I've seen you guys have filmed like some inlets and boat traffic areas by drone. A lot of times people are running over it and probably just don't even see them, right? So it's a little bit of an ignorance of bliss thing.
Hitting ray that didn't know they hit a ray.
Yeah. Yeah. This reminds me of one time I was fishing a trip. I had two guys that wanted to catch jack crevalles. So we were fishing the jack schools that you see migrating up the beach all the time. And we were coming back to the inlet. We were just, you know, near Bathtub Beach, just outside it. And we saw a little school, and the guy said, hey, can we each catch one more real quick? We had had a really fun day. We were going as, yeah, let's just take the plugs real quick. We'll each catch one more. So we both hooked up, or they both hooked up to jack crevalle, and they're fighting them. And we're kind of doing the dance of two anglers hooked up, moving around the boat, and a giant, giant hammerhead blitzed the jack crevalles against the reef. So we're all, you know, screaming and having a good time, and it's crazy. And it wasn't on the fish that we were hooked up to. It was blitzing just the you know, population that was kind of moving south down the beach there. And there was all these big splashes, and it sounded like cannonballs going off. And we were screaming, and we landed jack one, released it, landed jack two. I think the hammer probably finally got the guy he had targeted out of the school, and he moved on. And we started putting in, and we had ended it just on a totally 10 out of 10 adrenaline driven, you know, ninth inning. And we putted past the boat on anchor, and they said, how's fishing? And we said, that was pretty crazy, huh? And they said, what? And I said, you didn't see the giant hammerhead like thrashing, like sending fish flying everywhere. This hammerhead's hundreds and hundreds of pounds. All these jacks are 20 to 30 pounds. It happened 50 feet behind their outboard motor. They said, no, we didn't see it. What happened? So it's just kind of this, like, you have to realize not everyone is going to be the next Flip Palette and as in tune with their surroundings. But that doesn't mean that it's not something worthy of trying to bridge that gap. And the boating thing is probably, you know, as much of an issue, I'm sure, as the angling issue when it comes to hooks versus prop scars on them.
Yeah, absolutely. And one thing I like to share with people that people might not know, is that manta rays have the biggest brain of any fish. So, and they don't just have like a big brain because they're like a ginormous fish. They have a big brain for their body size. So it's kind of a cool fact. Like I like to think of sometimes manta rays act more like marine mammals than they do like another kind of fish. Like they're very social creatures. They'll come check you out and be like, what are you? And, you know, I've even had some like let me remove fishing line from them. They basically kind of like swim in little circles below me and let me just kind of untangle it and cut it off. And I feel like people don't know that about manta rays. They're kind of just like, oh, it's just like another fish out there, but it's actually kind of this really like unique creature.
That's really cool. I did not know that about the brain size. And yeah, I think that's like an interesting challenge when it comes to human interactions with wild populations of fish or marine life in general, is like this consideration. And I guess terrestrial life as well is like, we have these associations with like personas for animals. And some of them were really are near and dear to our hearts. And those endearing personas make us really want to protect, be very thoughtful around them, and then not so thoughtful around other things because it's just a big dumb animal. And so, you know, it's interesting to hear that. And maybe anglers might look at it as, you know, it's not a stingray, right? Like a stingray, when you go up by the ramp, it's sitting in the mud. That thing's moving and doing nothing. I don't know about that thing's brain size, but sounds a lot less advanced than mantas. So that's really interesting to hear and makes you appreciate your interaction with them a little bit more.
Yeah. And it's cool, like talking about like changing perceptions, like back in the early 1900s, if you look at old newspaper articles, they would be like the giant devil fish. And everyone was like terrified of them. And like some of the only research I could find when I started this project was old fishing articles. Because people in Florida used to go out and harpoon them and, you know, follow them around for hours. There's a Teddy Roosevelt wrote an article about harpooning the devilfish. And there's a picture of him, I think in Boca Grande, with like two mantas on the beach that he harpooned.
Back when we were really thoughtful. Yeah, it's very nice to get into the black and white archives of what we used to know and how we used to perceive the ocean. Yeah, harpooning mantas pretty low on our low on the totem pole. Yeah. You know, it is interesting when you reference harpooning, kind of makes me think about human effects on behaviors and how we can certain pressures can almost select out a behavior. And so, like, I know there are swordfish fisheries around the globe where, like, people run up and throw a harpoon in a swordfish that are floating on the surface. And I know there are areas where that fishery has largely gone away. And I assume that is largely related to a selection of, like, hey, the ones that do come up to the surface, they're getting, if you harpoon every fish that comes up to the surface, it's going to change, you know, that trait within the population. And I'd be curious how angling a pressure over the last couple of decades and a major, major increase in boating activity and angling activity has affected the migration of mantas. Do they migrate deeper down now? Do they migrate further off the beach than they used to? I'm sure you guys kind of have those thoughts in your head already, but I would be curious to see how that has changed things.
Yeah, a lot of anglers have brought that up. And, you know, I don't think it's really possible to tease apart from the past because we know so little and it's so complicated because we don't even really know exactly what's driving the migration. Is it water temperature? Is it food? Is it ocean fronts? Are they stopping places to mate? There could be all these different things. So it's tricky.
And my understanding is you talked about Mozambique, and I've seen some of the other places where there's a lot of ecotourism around protecting the atolls, and people travel, you know, hours and hours and hours and allocate a lot of resources to go do these beautiful dives with them. Where is the hub of manta understanding and conservation? Because I know you work with this larger group, the Marine Megafauna Foundation, right? So where is our current understanding of mantas in general, recognizing that there could be different subpopulations and there's multiple species? Where is most of the understanding of mantas come from right now?
So it's mostly, so right now there's two recognized species of manta ray, the giant manta and the reef manta. The reef manta is like in the Indo-Pacific, and it kind of associates with coastal reef environments. And the giant manta is kind of this offshore kind of nomad. And then we have the that's the giant manta is technically what we have on our coast right now, although we're working on describing a new species right now. But most of what we know is based on that reef manta, just because they're much, much easier to study. And where our knowledge is, the founder of the Marine Megafauna Foundation, Andrea Marshall, did the first PhD on manta rays in 2009. So it's like, they've really only been studied for like two decades. But they're getting a lot more attention now. So we're learning a lot more. But I remember when I first started this project, there was just like hardly any published data. I had like Andrea's thesis printed out, and it was like my Bible of like what to know about manta rays. So yeah, it's really cool. And I would like to ask, since this is like a fishing community all up the Atlantic coast that we're talking to right now, right? So I'm also
all around the country, all the way through the Gulf. We also have some international listeners, which is kind of crazy. So to our couple people in Poland who are listening, you know, it's funny how podcasts expand in a way that, like, you know, our core network and our core community share it, but also it's discoverable by getting into top charts. And so people find it in weird ways. So our heat map for listeners is really funny. It's amusing how much international traffic we have as well. So we have listeners all up and down the coast. So their ears are all yours for any requests they can do to contribute.
Well, I'm requesting, so for mantas and their smaller cousins, the devil rays, if you ever see one, take a photo and send it to us. It's like really important information. I'd be especially interested in like the farther north we go, like above Florida, because, you know, the mantas go all the way up off the coast of New York State. But we know very little about them up there. But also the other smaller mobula species, even though they're like 9 feet across, some of them. But like those, even the devil rays are even lesser studied than the manta rays. And I'm also doing some work with them. And, you know, a lot of the information we have is from anglers. Or I'm publishing a paper that has so much angler information right now. So it's just really important.
One of the things that gets said a lot, whether it's in clean water conversations or fisheries conversations, is the fishing guide is kind of like the canary in the coal mine. They're on the water so much more than the average, marine environment participant. And they're also so much more in tune to, you know, if someone's retired and they just go out on their boat every day because they want to enjoy the sun, it's a little bit different than a fishing guide who's really in tune to everything from, you know, the salinity, the water temperature, changing currents, all the different, you know, they're looking in the water for all the different interactions that are occurring. And that's a wealth of information. And a vast majority of those guys, you're really seeing stewardship pick up steam in the fishing industry. And that's one of the things we're proud to be a part of, is that movement. And so they have all this information. Hopefully this leads to a couple people who will send you, whether it's historical accounts, or I'm assuming it doesn't just have to be from now on, right? You know, if someone has an iPhone photo.
No, historical accounts are more than welcome.
So where should they send stuff?
Yes.
What social handles? What email? We'll put this in the blog.
You can Google Florida Manta Project and you will find our website online. I'm on Instagram at Florida Manta Girl. Or you can email us at florida@marinemegafauna.org.
Okay.
I can give you all that stuff.
Yeah, we'll write all those out for the non-auditory listeners. But yeah, anyone who has listened this far obviously is very intrigued by it. I think one thing that's cool is anytime we're discovering, it's really exciting. Maybe it's the marine biologist in me. Anyone who isn't excited about it hasn't made it 39 minutes with us anyway, so we don't need those ears. But But really cool stuff. Unless you have any parting words or anything you want to add, what we'd request is, you know, people check out the little video they made about angling around mantas. You might be intrigued, whether that's to improve your angling skills or just because you've never even knew this was an angling opportunity. If you just want to see some really cool drone and underwater videos of cobia and what they do with rays, we'll get that video linked into our socials and our blog. Send in any historical evidence anytime you've interacted with one of these creatures on the water so we can continue to grow that knowledge base. And unless you got anything else, we just really appreciate you stopping by and sharing. And really, I said this to you before the podcast and I said, I don't want to say any more because I don't want to forget to say it. And I almost did, but I really appreciate how you guys are coming to this, you know, recognizing that the angling community can provide info and can provide a better understanding of the species and that they have a negative impact, but didn't villainize the community, right? It's not, oh my God, everyone shut down the ocean. The fishermen are killing the manta rays. It's, hey, you guys are having this interaction. You're not getting anything out of hooking the rays. How can we get better together? And I think that fosters really productive conversation and productive campaigns. So on behalf of the fishing community, thank you for that. Really appreciate it.
Well, I mean, the problem was brought to me by the fishing community. We learned more about it from the fishing community. And that's why on the video, I didn't want it to be me talking, because who wants to listen to me talk about fishing? I don't know about fishing. So I'm really thankful to the anglers, Blair Wiggins, Scott Lum, and Joey Antonelli, who all worked with us. I'm just really thankful for their help and everyone who participated in our study as well.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, send in your manta reports if you got them, dig through your old fishing photos, and hopefully we'll have you back here. If you ever have any crazy discoveries, you want to, there's a new survey or anything you're doing that you'd like the angling community, I'm sure listeners here would love to continue to participate. So thank you very much. Happy Valentine's Day. Go enjoy it with your love for mantas and our love for fish. And hopefully we'll have you back here soon.
Sounds good. Thanks, Cody.